Good morning, everybody. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the February 27, 2018 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, we'll devote the full hour to Keramit Reiter, UCI Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society, to talk about her new book, 23-7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinements, published by Yale University Press. Originally, we had arranged to have joining her Michael Saavedra, who was detained in solitary confinement for 10 years of his 19-year prison sentence, from which he was released February of 2017. However, Michael was in a motorcycle accident last night and is canceling. We're going to send every good wish to him in his recovery. We'll talk about him as we cover this immensely important topic that's not been clearly enough on all of our radar. Keramit's research and Michael's experience yield stories of deprivation that exceed the darkest of Charles Dickinson's passages. We'll be right back after a station break. Welcome back, folks. My guest for the whole hour is Keramit Reiter, UCI Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society, and she's also has a joint appointment at the law school. Our other guest who we had planned to have join us was Michael Saavedra. He's a former detainee in several California penal institutions. He was injured in, I'm going to curse the rain last night when I'm sure it was starting in his Riverside location. He is unable to join us. He's shattered a femur, and we're all going to cover this like it's going to bring him back to complete good health. We'll introduce in a few words right now Keramit. She is a professor of UCI's Department of Criminology, Law, and Society and UCI's Law School. She studies prisons, prisoners' rights, and the impact of prison and punishment on individuals, communities, and whole legal systems. Her research is based on interviews, archival and legal analysis, and of course, the essential number crunching analysis, thereby documenting the history and impact of criminal justice policies. The arena in which we shall focus today is that of long-term solitary confinement in the U.S., mainly in California. She's worked as an associate at Human Rights Watch, has testified before the Senate and federal legislators, and appeared on National Public Radio's Hidden Brain, WYPR, Rising Up with Sonali Okatkar on KPFK, The Lines of Liberty podcast, LA Times, Time Magazine, The American Scholar, and Prison Legal News, among other many media outlets. She completed her bachelor's at Harvard University, her master's of arts at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and her PhD and her law degree at the University of California at Berkeley. Michael was going to be on. I'm going to just introduce him so there's a little bit of background so that when we talk about him, and we will talk about him as an outlier, as a most resilient detainee that has endured solitary confinement for such long periods of time, that we'll refer back to him from time to time. He spent 10 of his 19 years in solitary confinement, wherein and he participated in all of the group hunger strikes, which we'll talk about. He learned the law himself. He studied it and successfully litigated several lawsuits against the Department of Corrections in California for his unjust and humane treatment. Michael is now, he's 47 years old. He's currently involved in several community organizations supporting and assisting the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated population. Well, I hope we'll be able to talk about the communications with detainees who've been released and those that are inside. That's one of the many kinds of pipelines that make all of this advocacy a very problematic matter. He is a Riverside City College student. He's a UCLA Beyond the Bars Fellow, a paralegal, and a youth mentor at La Cosa in East Los Angeles. Keramit joins me in studio today and helped me chew on the big piece that we're biting off here collectively for this whole hour. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Keramit Reiter.
Thanks so much for having me, Claudia.
Well, somewhere along the line American jurisprudence history was this Calvinist legacy imbuing punitive over rehabilitative policies. And I think that that sort of clouds over the entire framework of our penal institutions in this country. Mm-hmm. Well, this is an amazing read. It's been out. It's been out for like about a year
about
and a quarter.
Year. Yeah.
And which I hope that all of you listening will pick it up with its utter accessibility. The book is clearly written for the general audience. And for California, now this topic of solitary confinement, specifically for California, this story began on August 21st, 1971, when San Quentin detainee George Jackson was killed during a prison escape attempt that to this day remains to be fully investigated. It's the story started in 1999 for you, Kermit, when you started teaching inmates in various California detention centers. For Michael, it started somewhere around 1998 with the beginning of his 21-year-to-life sentence. So, Kermit, tell us about the importance, the power of the man, the symbol of George Jackson in California penal institutions all the way since that day in August 1971.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, this was one of the big surprises of researching this book, was as a scholar of punishment in the United States, I thought supermaxes were a story of mass incarceration. I thought places like Pelican Bay Security Housing Unit, where Michael was detained for so long, were places that I knew they were built in the 1980s. They were built when states like California were building dozens of new prisons to incarcerate the many people who were, you know, the increasing rates of incarceration in the state.
New, shiny, clean.
Exactly. I mean, hyper technologically advanced, bright new prisons. And so that was the story I thought I would be telling, was a story of the kinds of prisons that were built in the 80s and 90s as part of this buildup of mass incarceration. But as I started to dig deeper into this narrative, I kept meeting prison administrators who'd worked in prison building in the 1980s, who kept pointing me back much further, two decades further back, to the story of George Jackson in 1971. And the story they tell, and you know, I'm always amazed when I talk to people about this, how few people really remember George Jackson. In the 1970s, he was incredibly well-known, a best-selling author.
Well, partly, do you think that there's a relationship between an unresolved, if it had been investigated fully and resolved, there would be a sort of more traction. There would be, there would have been more transparency. There would have been a full story. If it's a half-baked story, and
and
there's no advocacy,
right.
There's a disenfranchised population sector. So all of those things make for no story. You got to be at least maybe in your mid, early 50s to even older. Maybe I'm in my age. I do remember that whole.
Right. People who lived in...
I didn't know it was August 21st, but yeah. I remember in the early 70s. What a blowout.
People who lived in California in the 1970s certainly remember, I think. But, you know,
the state.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But the younger generation, I think, doesn't always remember. But at the time, George Jackson was really well known. And that was part of the problem, was he had become known as an incredibly powerful and eloquent advocate for prisoners' rights at a time when the law was really changing. And, you know, as one prison official said to me, there was a civil rights movement outside of prison, but it felt like there was a radical revolution inside of prison. And so George Jackson was advocating for really drastic changes to the prison system with violent overthrow if needed. So he had become a real thorn in the side of the prison system. And all that's known about August 21st, 1971 is that Jackson ran out of the isolation unit where he was being held at San Quentin, which should have been very secure. He was immediately shot in the back on the prison yard and died on the spot. And when officers ran...
And left there.
Exactly. And when officers ran back into the adjustment center, that was what they called the isolation unit there, they found that two other prisoners and three other officers had been stabbed to death. So there's still debate about exactly what happened. Some people say that Jackson's lawyer smuggled a gun into him inside a tape recorder. It's a little bit of a far-fetched story, the gun that was never found.
The gun that was never found, yeah. the model they mentioned doesn't fit in that.
Yes, exactly. Some people say that Jackson was set up because he had been such a threat to the system, and so he was set up as an excuse to kill him. And really, no one knows. And part of the importance of this story is that to have the most violent day in the California prison system, when the most people died ever, be still a mystery as to what exactly happened, shows just how hidden these institutions are and how much discretion there is in operating them. And also the fact that people point to this day, anyone who's worked in the California prisons can tell you that Saturday, August 21st, 1971 was the deadliest day in California prison history. The fact that that day still has such powerful resonance for prison officials in the system is also really important for understanding the kinds of things they were afraid of when they built supermaxes like Pelican Bay. And that's what prison officials say, is that they needed a place to contain people like George Jackson, the people who were associated with him and his revolutionary movement. And in fact, the one person whose conviction stuck over the years for allegedly helping George Jackson escape was Hugo Pinnell. He was locked down the day Jackson tried to escape.
The record keeper.
Yeah.
40? How many
More
years?
Than 40 years.
40 years he in solitary.
In solitary. He was put in solitary in 1971, and he was one of the first people transferred to Pelican Bay 18 years later when it opened in 1989. And he was there until the reforms just a few years ago. Very sadly, he died. He was murdered when he was released from Pelican Bay. That's another story.
Well, we'll get into that story. Is it how complicit some of, if we could get to that, the guards are in sort of setting people up to the gladiator sort of situation. But we'll get into that. But if I do this job right, I'm going to give our listeners an opportunity to sort of get into the sort of sensory aspect of this. We don't have Michael's benefit of explaining to us on a personal level, but you do go to some really interesting lengths to give us a feel for how utterly otherworldly this whole setting is. Well, let's give everybody a chance to sort of understand this whole context then. The penal institution administrators wanted to really create an infrastructure that it was all about protecting the guards' lives, and then not so much the prisoners. And so that makes sense. And you give us actually an amazing bar graph that shows the deaths of prisoners, the deaths of wardens, and the suicides. And the wardens' deaths are practically hugging the zero bar for the duration for the history since the 70s or before the 70s.
Since the 1980s, there have been, you know, we can count on one hand the number of officers who've been killed in California state prison. So not to say that it can't be a very scary job with violence involved, but the moment when Jackson died was an unusually violent moment where there were a lot of assaults in the prison, and it was a real outlier. And so, you know, a lot of policies have been built around this snapshot in time in the 1970s.
So let's talk about the design of the Pelican Bay Prison. It's in Del Norte County.
Exactly, on the northern border with Oregon.
Folks, that's by design to have it be so very remote for people that are advocates, all kinds of people,
to get to there.
It takes quite a long time. If you could give us I'm asking you to just do a huge sweep here of the legislative, there's the administrative, there's the architectural, and there's a financial history. All of those pieces were crucial in creating this particular kind of brand new prison concept. So let's start with that legislative history and the Riverside County. That's where Michael lives now. But State Senator Presley, among others that were going to make this all happen.
Yeah.
So give us your favorite thumbnail of how the administrative, the legislative, and we'll get into some of the architectural and lurid detail afterward.
Absolutely. So this was another surprise of doing the research. First, you have to understand the history, that there was this powerful story of how dangerous George Jackson was that motivated the institution. But then you have to get down to the nitty gritty of, well, okay, who actually built the thing and who designed it? And there again, as a citizen of California, I expected to see ballot propositions, because I think of criminal justice issues as something we all vote on regularly in this state.
Open
with the proposition system. Exactly. And so when I started the research, I started looking in the 1980s 1980s for what kind of voting there might have been, either among the citizens or among the legislators, about the idea to build this brand new prison. Pelican Bay is still one of the biggest long-term isolation units in the U.S., and many states have copied the model. And so, you know, I was interested in, you know, how did this idea come about? And to my great surprise, there was nothing. There's no ballot proposition that mentions Pelican Bay. And the only thing I found in the legislative archives after combing through was a really flippant discussion by the Legislative Prison Building Committee, led by Senator Presley, who you mentioned, that was just an aside about the fact that, yes, there was going to be a prison built in Del Norte County. And should they call it Slammer by the Sea or Casa No Pasa?
Skeleton Bay.
Skeleton Bay. Yeah. So there were all these jokes about the nicknames. So some sense that it would be a high security prison, but no sense about the kind of hyper security, the novel technology that would be used, the kinds of total isolation that would be implemented with basically no end in sight, and not much conversation about that. And so I had to really then get creative about how to figure out who had built this institution, since there wasn't a legislative record. And that journey led me to talk to many prison administrators, and it was prison administrators who built this institution.
You had a relationship with them, and as you really probed, you picked up every single rock there was put it together.
A fascinating piece of this project to try to understand what the folks who worked in California prisons were thinking. And, you know, part of that was the Jackson story, and part of that was this idea that as they were building new prisons, they needed one, at least, super high security facility. And, you know, the prison official in charge of prison construction in California in the 1980s was Carl Larson, and he told me the story of going around the country looking for the model of the highest security prison and finding a prototype in Arizona. It was the last place he visited. He was so excited when he found what Arizona called the Security Management Unit. It was this place where guards didn't have to interact with prisoners at all, because it was so automated and people were in such total isolation. And he said, I want a bigger, better one for California with better lines of sight for the guns to make sure that people from the guard towers would be able to see straight into those cells and control the prisoners that way. And that's what he built. The Arizona facility had a few hundred beds. California built 1,056 beds.
And we'll get back to bed numbers here in a bit when we get into the full-on architectural aspect. So, and Carl Larson, along with Presley and a few others, not too many, it's a small circle of friends, folks, that they created this general obligation bond measure that there's the financial aspect, the liability there should be a concern to taxpayers, as well as it was another way to sort of keep off the radar this massively, elaborately brand new infrastructure in the penal institution system.
Absolutely. So prison officials, you know, part of the story is prison officials designed this institution, not necessarily architects, not necessarily legislators.
No.
And then the question is, well, how did they have that power? And the explanation is that over the course of the 1980s, California was building so many prisons so fast. There were 23 new prisons built in the state in the 1980s and 1990s, that the legislature and the California Department of Corrections worked together.
And Governor Duke Majan was sort of like just kind of giving it imprimatur
off on the sidelines.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they worked together to develop all these kind of efficient mechanisms to make prison building as streamlined as possible. And so the first few new prisons that were built were funded by public obligation bonds. This is why I thought I'd see things in the public, you know, like ballot propositions, because everyone was voting on them. But that became a very unwieldy process very quickly. And so the legislature and the Department of Corrections agreed to privatize the bond process, and they made lease revenue bonds instead. Of course, those are a little more expensive because they're not backed by the full faith and credit of the government. They're private bonds that are negotiated with corporations.
But that drives up our price.
Exactly. That makes the interest rates higher and makes the whole process more expensive. But it's much quicker because you don't have to go before the public to get the approval. And that's just one example of the kinds of workaround mechanisms that were designed. You know, there were lots of legislative rubber stamping when a prison plan like the one for Pelican Bay went before the legislature. If there wasn't a hearing within a few weeks, it would be deemed automatically approved and it could go forward. Lots of environmental exemptions that had existed previously for building these kinds of structures. So they designed all kinds of mechanisms to make the process more efficient. And that also meant it became much less transparent in practice.
So, folks, tag privatization. We're going to, because there are some intersections with some national leadership. agendas afoot here. For those of you who've just joined us, my guest here on Ask a Leader is Keramet Reiter. She's UCI professor of criminology, law, and society, talking about her book, 23/7 Pelican Bay and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. It's published by Yale University Press. And we do this show thinking of Michael Saavedra, who is going to be joining us. He served at 10 years of his 19-year sentence in solitary confinement, and mainly in some of it in Corcoran, but mainly in Pelican Bay, where he's released. So we're all wishing him well. He was unable to join us today due to a motorcycle accident he was in last night. We will get back to him as we talk about some of the oppressive aspects of this whole setting. So I want you to break down now the whole lurid architectural details. It's you've given us some graphics in your book. The cover, folks, when you pull up 23/7 on the internet and when you're ordering your own personal copy, the cages that are on the cover of the book are just one example of this extreme treatment. That this is how they're caged to move about out of their cell. This is where Michael did all of his legal research. If you can imagine doing work in this kind of position in this cage, propping up your material,
So they're cages that look like telephone booths, except they're made of fencing and they're on wheels, and it's where someone would do legal research or maybe even see a doctor, a therapist if they needed to. California ironically calls them therapeutic treatment modules, which often gets a good laugh.
Oh wow. So there. So let's talk about then the design, the kind of door that Carl Larson he figured, I mean, that these guys were doing it on the fly, and they had, because they had more money than Arizona, they could really get good with this.
Yeah. So these are part of what's so interesting about supermaxes, these long-term solitary facilities, is how technologically advanced they were and all the little innovations that were designed to restrict sensory inputs for prisoners, essentially. So I mentioned Pelican Bay has 1,056 isolation beds. They're grouped together into these pods of eight. So there's four cells on the bottom, four cells on the top, and they're made of solid poured concrete. So everything
even
is
the
very
bed
smooth. Exactly. Even the bed. So it's like one mold that it's poured in. There's a steel toilet sink combination in one corner, and each cell is about 8 by 10 feet. So imagine a wheelchair accessible bathroom stall or a parking space. Pretty small. There are no windows. There are fluorescent lights that remain on 24 hours a day.
Now they can't. There was something reference about dimming them, but they're.
Well, one of the, there are all these weird technological innovations. So as I understand it, people like Michael have described this to me.
Yeah.
There's a light switch that you can, it's like a friction switch. So you just can rub your hand on it and you can dim the light, but you can never turn it all the way off. But there's no actual, it's not even a switch. So the idea is these places are just completely smooth so that there's nothing you could break off to hurt yourself with or to hurt someone else with. There's nothing that you could hang yourself on. So they're really designed to be just completely smooth, no texture. And it's just the concrete color, except the doors, which you mentioned, are painted red and they're this perforated steel. So people describe you can almost put a pinky finger through the hole. And that's sometimes people who visit isolation say they can barely touch someone just by touching their pinky finger, if you can imagine. And that's sometimes the extent of the human touch anyone has over the course of years.
So since you mentioned that, and there's a tell in your book where there is a point where the guards can open up, they can electronically, it slides the door open, and usually it's meant that only one door opens at a time because you never know, but the security of two prisoners, there could be some sort of a deal between them, and they one could take the other one out. But there, you mentioned, and maybe I should let you tell the story about how the two adjacent prisoners accidentally, but they didn't know the story. But what was that? Moment occurred that to tell us about this deprivation and the technology?
So one thing to understand about these facilities, I told you there's pods of eight, four cells on the bottom, four on the top. But one officer is basically in the center of what Bentham would have called a panopticon, and he looks out over multiple pods at a time. So he looks out over six pods of eight cells or 48 cells from the center, and he controls one door at a time through a computer. So this is again how there doesn't need to be any human contact. Officer in the central booth just presses a button, one door at a time opens, and that prisoner can go out, if he's lucky, for his hour a day to a shower or an exercise yard. Prisoners in Isolation talk about the fact that it's kind of scary that if something malfunctions with the computer, and there were malfunctions with the doors when Pelican Bay first opened, you know, two cells' doors could be opened, and often prisoners are on blocks where, you know, an alleged rival gang member is their neighbor, someone, you know, someone who they would genuinely be afraid of. And so this idea that two doors might open at once is something people have nightmares about in isolation. But one of the prisoners I interviewed for this
and they
project,
have enough to process.
Yeah,
exactly. Or try to process.
Exactly.
Okay. We're not joking. We're just, it's.
Yeah, no, it's.
Karameth just has a vibe that, you know, she's got to see, she's got to keep it together here.
Well, and it's ironic that these places, on the one hand, there's so much sensory deprivation, and on the other hand, the kinds of sensory inputs, like lights on all the time, or like the noise of clanging doors, can be overwhelming. So one of the prisoners I interviewed told me this amazing story about having been in isolation for years, and the thing he was afraid of happened. His door and his neighbor's door popped open, and they were indeed alleged to be from rival gangs. And instead of anything happening, like, you know, either of them rushing out, they had talked to each other. They'd been next to each other, so you can shout on the pod and communicate a little bit between these cells. He sees this hand reaching around the wall between the cell doors, and he reaches his hand out, and they just hold hands for a couple minutes because neither
that
of them...
That long? Even a couple minutes? I mean,
I think before they noticed, before the officers noticed, both doors were open, and neither of them had a physical human touch beyond someone maybe putting handcuffs on them in years. And so it was this incredibly powerful moment he narrated to me of just, you know, even though it wasn't maybe his first choice or someone he would have thought of as a friend, that was their kind of first instinct, was to just experience that human touch. I think that's gives you a powerful sense of how isolating the conditions can be. Prisoners talk about going years at a time without seeing the moon or a bird, or, you know, a spider can be really exciting if it walks by.
All right. Well, we're tracking first the architectural aspects as well as the center. I mean, they're actually they keep it's an interplay here between covering both of those. So, and then for 23/7, there's an hour out of the day. And so describe what that particular what that sort of, what's it like, a walking not a running space, but what that particular, where the whole hour gets. And it's also of concern that for the longest time before some of these hunger strikes reformed some of the practices, that they were very exposed at Pelican Bay when they would go out for that 1 hour. So anyway, tell us about that place where that 1 hour out of the day reprieve occurred.
Exactly.
Reprieve, I say, loosely.
So, and in general, you know, at best it's an hour. In practice, usually it's a couple times a week. A prisoner might get out for an hour or two. During that time, they could shower. So that block of eight cells I described, there's one shower and one what's called a yard attached to that block of eight. And that's intentional. That's because in an 8 hour shift, the idea is an officer could get each of those eight prisoners out for an hour to the shower and to the yard. That yard that's attached to the end of the pod of the cells is about twice the size of one of the cells. And it's another poured concrete box. A lot of prisoners have described it to me as like being at the bottom of an emptied out swimming pool, which I think is a particularly vivid. I wish Michael were here to evoke this
for us. We all do. Listeners too.
And then there's a little bit of natural light. So there's a skylight in that exercise yard area, and prisoners can pace. They have, you know, they have a little bit more access to air. But again, there's that problem of, you know, you're lucky if a bird flies over. Del Norte County is quite cold. It's right on the coast.
Wet cold.
Yes, damp cold. And when the prisoners went on hunger strike at Pelican Bay to protest the conditions between 2011 and 2013, a lot of the things they asked for had to do with the exercise yard. So they said, can we have a wool cap to keep us warm when we go out in the winter? And they said, could we maybe have a handball or a pull-up bar or something to do on that concrete yard beyond just pacing? Judge Henderson, who oversaw some litigation of the conditions here, described one of his most vivid memories as just looking from a guard tower and seeing someone pacing like a caged animal in one of these yards.
That figure eight sort of classic thing that we can know from the worst of the worst of their zoo designs. So you mention later in the book about let's finish off some of this sensory aspect here. It's not finished. Michael, when you hear this podcast, we're really making a short work of all of what you've experienced. That the visitor, or let's not the visitor, but the newly detained person, they've been in transit, they get to smell a few redwoods and some other things, and then they come into Pelican Bay's solitary confinement facility wings, and there is the smell.
Prisoners, I mean, you know, one way I've described this is just that there's a certain feel to letters that come from prisoners in isolation, of this paper that's incredibly soft because it's been so carefully handled. Often they're only allowed a few pieces of paper, and so you get this tiny, tiny print on it. And there's a kind of institutional, if you're lucky, an institutional, hygienic, but very stale smell to the paper. And that's similar, at least, to what people have described about these places. And, you know, sometimes people say they're incredibly quiet. It can be kind of haunting. If no one is talking and there's no one on these tiers, you just hear the echo of the doors opening and closing. Sometimes people say it can be really loud if an officer is counting and there's, yeah, where people are shouting at each other. And it's, you can imagine the echoing with the concrete and no insulation.
But I want you to talk about, if you can, in greater detail, but that the smell is of a very depressed, destitute, kind of, it's a very sinister, very forbidding smell of people that have no hope, people in indeterminate, well, then they're determinate now, the indeterminate sentences.
Right. I mean, you know, imagine a place with very little air circulation because there aren't windows, where guys have lived for years at a time, where they're trying to maintain their sanity by exercising in their cell. So often there's a little bit of a smell of sweat. You know, one of the things that's really disturbingly common in isolation is that people deteriorate mentally, and sometimes they smear their excrement on their cells. And so sometimes there's that smell on the unit if it hasn't been cleaned up. And then that's kind of intermixed with this institutional, like a hospital smell of cleaning products that are trying to cover this up. So it can be that wave of smell that you have when you come on. Again, it's interesting because it's an intense sensory input, but then there's all of these ways in which your senses are dulled all around you also.
And you mentioned about them trying to stay, you know, to keep some kind of physical regimen, but in that it takes a lot of ingenuity, which the most resilient ones can claim to, but ingenuity to try to figure out a workout session in an 8x10.
Exactly.
With or without another person in there.
Exactly.
And I want to backtrack too on an architectural aspect that Carl Larson, before the bid went out to pour the concrete for all of these units, is that he realized he wanted to double up on the bedding capacity. So he had originally, but I guess those aren't there anymore from the pictures that you're showing us. They're side by side now, but earlier pods were double bunks with only 3 feet between those two concrete slabs.
Yep. One of the innovations California put in was at the last minute they realized they might need more than 1,056 isolation beds.
They were on a roll with
Maximus. And so they actually added extra bunks, which, you know, in the vast majority of the time today, prisoners are alone in these cells, and so that bunk kind of serves as a shelf. There were periods in the early 1990s when, you know, over half of Pelican Bay was what we call double bunked. So there were two prisoners in an 8x10 cell, 23 or more hours a day. And it's hard to know what's worse, being completely alone or being locked in a cell with one other person. And there are debates about, you know, in states that have looked at this, it seems like it's incredibly dangerous. Assaults do tend to happen under those conditions. And, you know, it's hard to imagine, even for me, what it would be like to spend that much time in close quarters with someone.
So by now, everybody's wondering that this sounds so unbelievably inhumane. And you plot the kind of history of how there were some near misses in oversight occurring. Judge Henderson was a real outlier in the judicial system, who took a lot of pains he tried to figure out when he could visit Pelican Bay to find out what was really going on. And the wardens kind of set him up with a few things, but he couldn't believe what he was being shown. If they were letting him see that, he knew there were a lot of worse things that were not being presented. So if you could give us a sort of thumbnail of how the unwittingly or wittingly legal decisions sort of, and I don't want to say cemented, because that's a terrible pun, but how they institutionalized the system that persisted up until the hunger strikes and still past the hunger strikes.
the story of the legal oversight of Pelican Bay is fascinating. Maybe I'm biased as a lawyer, but, you know, partly Judge Henderson learned about Pelican Bay when he started getting letters from prisoners there describing how horrific the conditions were. And that's just yet another piece of evidence about how hidden it was, how little people knew about it when it was opened. And his first instinct, you know, if people know Judge Henderson, Northern District judge in sitting on the bench in San Francisco, federal judge, known for very liberal decisions on everything from dolphin safe tuna to benefits for military veterans to prisoners' rights. He just retired a couple months ago.
Oh, he did.
But he got these letters and he got very interested in what was happening at Pelican Bay. And he very quickly certified a class of all the prisoners at Pelican Bay right after it opened in the early 1990s to investigate and appointed lawyers to investigate whether the conditions there were constitutional. And one of the things he found, the triumph of the case, is that he said seriously mentally ill prisoners cannot be placed in these conditions, and they have to be sorted out basically and placed in other facilities where they have access to adequate medical and mental health care and where they at least have some access to natural light, some kind of windows. And that point in the case has been, you know, many other states have followed suit and referenced Judge Henderson's decision, and the case was called Madrid v. Gomez.
Yes.
But the other fundamental question in the case is, are these kind of conditions we're talking about, this kind of sensory deprivation for years at a time, are they constitutional? Does it violate the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment?
For years at a time, and I want to quickly add, and for an indefinite sort of duration, which
exactly.
How does one psychologically even
exactly
handle that?
And there, Judge Henderson found that the conditions were constitutional. And I think there's two really important ways to understand that. One is that judges like Judge Henderson and other federal court judges over the course of the 70s and 80s had looked at prison conditions all over the U.S. and they had seen dirty, filthy, overcrowded cells with inadequate lighting, where prisoners were getting inadequate food. And they had said again and again in cases across the U.S., you have to give prisoners adequate lighting. You can't have them in dirt cells. They have to have adequate food. And it turns out Pelican Bay was built to exactly those minimum specifications. It's clean. It's easy to hose down when it gets dirty. The lights are on 24 hours a day. With a few exceptions, it's not usually overcrowded. There's one prisoner to that cell. They get exactly measured the number of calories that are required to survive every day in their food. There's running water in the cell.
Well, wait, the calories to survive without the workout.
Exactly.
The workout changes that whole formula.
Exactly. They get the minimum calories that would be required.
If you're sedentary.
Also. Exactly. And so that's one way the institution turned out. Once they made sure seriously mentally ill prisoners weren't there, and once they made sure prisoners weren't being beaten up by officers, which was another problem, it was really hard to see the harm of this place. The kinds of struggles people have are very hard to measure and document because they tend to be very psychological. And they tend to be very long term, as I wish Michael could have talked to us about today of his own experiences and how, even though he's incredibly high functioning now, you know, I think he faces a lot of challenges from the long time he spent in isolation. So that's one piece of the story. The second really important piece of the story is that prison officials said that this was the place where the most dangerous prisoners in California
were.
The
worst.
The George Jacksons. And because they had so much discretion over who was sent there. You know, again, they had discretion in building the place. The question of who gets sent to Pelican Bay is a question that's determined by prison administrators on the ground based on in-prison
right.
behavior. There wasn't really even any documentation to examine whether they were the worst of the worst or not. And there was a lot of deference by courts, by judges like Judge Henderson, to that claim that they were the worst of the worst. And it was hard to even think about what evidence could be used to interrogate or challenge that claim because there wasn't a record. It wasn't like there'd been a court proceeding to establish that these people were dangerous. There was just what prison officials said. And in fact, you know, on one visit to Pelican Bay, they staged a riot that Judge Henderson witnessed
right.
just to establish how dangerous these prisoners were. And so that was another challenge of the case. And it wasn't until 2011 that people really, around the hunger strikes, people really began to say, wait, why are these guys there? And what is the evidence? And it turned out there often just wasn't any.
So the there's vocabulary here. It's called the security housing unit, and lots of you have heard the word CHU, and that's what we're talking about. For those of you who've just joined us, my guest is Keramet Reiter. She's UCI professor of criminology, law, and society. She's talking now about her book 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. It's published by Yale University Press, and it's available through your favorite independent book dealer. We're also bringing up Michael Saavedra, who was unfortunately able to join us today. He served in solitary for 10 of his 19 years. It was a 20-year prison sentence, mainly in Pelican Bay. And we will figure out a way that when he's recovered, and there will be a way he can weigh in with what he's experienced. He's been very generous. He's a very generous advocate and working on behalf of those that are back in there. And he's making a vocation of this. As a 47-year-old man, he wants to get a law degree, and he's going to put reform on all the front burners.
He's incredibly resilient and inspiring.
And a subset of this whole maimed population. Well, we were talking about the oversight here. Okay, let's talk about those hunger strikes then. Mm-hmm. They were pivotal. Important features that come to me are the sophistication that was required, mm-hmm. the kind of resourcefulness mm-hmm. of these detainees that were all over California, all over the country mm-hmm. to organize this. Mm-hmm. It was lawful. Mm-hmm. It was a defiant act, mm-hmm. but it was lawful. Mm-hmm. And how they overcame their own tribal differences mm-hmm. amongst the, mm-hmm. you know, the detainees, how on mm-hmm. earth did it even happen? Mm-hmm. And Michael participated in both the one in 2011 and 2013.
Incredibly inspiring story. And I think there's one key piece of backdrop to understand, which is that as of 2011, it came out as part of the hunger strikes that there were more than 500 prisoners who'd been detained in these conditions we've been talking about at Pelican Bay for more than 10 years. And that was because all of them had been labeled gang members by the state of California and been sent into isolation in the SHU indefinitely. So one of the things they were protesting was the fact that they wanted some hope that they might be able to get out. And just as one really important piece of backdrop to understand how they got labeled as gang members.
Yes, it was such an easy.
It was designed to be a very discretionary, flexible process. And what was required was three pieces of evidence in a prisoner's file to suggest they were a gang member. And the easiest way I can describe that evidence is anything that you might think of as a basic First Amendment right. So a prisoner's tattoo, what they were reading, including the letters of George Jackson, which makes sense with that history, who they were socializing with on a prison yard, maybe who they passed letters to, drawings they had, any three pieces of evidence like
that. An Aztec drawing makes you, the eyes of the wardens, a gang member.
Exactly. That could be one piece of evidence. And based on these three pieces of evidence, someone could be labeled a gang member and then sent to Pelican Bay indefinitely. And so that's how we ended up with these 500 guys who'd been there more than 10 years. It wasn't that they'd broken even some in-prison rule. In general, in California, if you attempt murder in prison, you're sent to isolation for 5 years. Again, based on an administrative in-prison process, not based on a trial. But that's just to give you some sense. These gang members were spending an even longer time than people who were accused of violent disciplinary infractions. So that's the backdrop to understand the hunger strike. Now, the incredible story of the strike, if you think back to that story I told about the two guys who held hands, there were pods in Pelican Bay where prison officials had gone out of their way to put alleged rival gang leaders. So imagine that pod of eight, and you've got eight guys from different gangs who've sworn never to talk to each other, or so the prison system thinks.
Tribes are tribes.
As a means of further isolating them, right? You might be able to talk to those other seven guys on your pod by shouting. Sometimes you could pass a note under that perforated steel door. But if there's
really?
Someone you would never talk to, then the idea is you'd be further isolated.
But, so let me, how does that yeah. work? Kermit. So you knew who was going to be. You could tell by the sound whose door was opening and slide that.
Well,
note
actually,
out to them.
The door doesn't quite seal.
I understand,
under
but
the
you
floor.
Have to know who's being released though to know who's getting your note, or does it matter? You just want to move the note. Period.
You just want to move the note. So okay. Sometimes when all you right. walk on these units, you'll actually see prisoners use lines. Sometimes they get a piece of elastic out of a piece of clothing, or they get a piece of string, and it's literally called fishing. And they'll attach it to a piece of paper, and they'll kind of sling it out under the cell and then sling it under someone else's door. If they get the wrong door, usually a prisoner would, you know, they could keep passing it on. So this is one way people communicate. They can pass notes this way. And this is part of what happened with the hunger strike. These guys were on this pod for so long together. They did start talking. They did pass notes.
And they had code, other kinds of and audio codes too, I guess.
I'm sure. And, you know, one of the things that happens on these units, sometimes prisoners will agree at 7 p.m. the guy on the bottom left can have a phone call with the guy on the top right cell, and everyone will be quiet while they shout at each other. So there's this sort of sense of respect that develops even in these kinds of extreme yes. conditions, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
But so these guys, these eight guys on this pod that was known as the Short Quarter, that was supposed to be filled with these rival gang leaders, over time got together with this plan to agree. They called it a cessation of hostilities. So to agree that the gangs would all collaborate together to refuse food in order to protest the conditions in Pelican Bay. So, you know, one of the things they were asking for is, can we have some hope that we'll be able to get out, that we won't be stuck with this label as gang members, no matter, you know, until we die or our criminal sentence expires. The phrase people used was, you only get out of the shoe if you parole, you snitch, or you die. So pretty depressing. You know, many people felt like there was no hope of any of those things for them. And so they got together and they asked for, they made a list of demands, including these things like the wool cap on the exercise yard, this idea that there'd be some review of their cases. They sent that list of demands out to all kinds of organizations, many in the Bay Area who had done prisoners' rights work. Those organizations sent those notices back into prisoners in other places throughout the state. And there was, you know,
and
in
then
the,
around the country, wasn't it?
Or exactly. In the summer of 2011, there started to be a buzz that there was going to be this hunger strike in California. And indeed, during the first strike, a few thousand prisoners refused food for 3 weeks. Eventually, the Department of Corrections sat down with the prisoners and said, you know, maybe we could give you some wool caps. They agreed that prisoners could have a photo a year in order to send it out to their family members who couldn't see them, so they could see have some connection with people, because it's very hard to go up and visit Pelican Bay. Family do visit that that visit happens behind bulletproof glass. So a lot of prisoners would just rather not have a visit under those
really?
Conditions.
Really?
To have you know, and the prisoners often remain cuffed. So just, you know, they feel so restrained, and it's so hard to see a family member and not be able to touch them. So these were the kinds of things the prisoners asked for. There were some small concessions made, but also as a result of the strike, for the first time, a journalist got this information that there were these 500 guys who'd been there more than 10 years. And that group of prisoners was quickly certified as a class. So in addition to this advocacy within prison, litigators stepped in to say, maybe we can try to reopen this case that Judge Henderson decided in the 90s. And let's see, you know, now that these guys have been there more than 10 years, do we have a new legal claim we can bring about it? The changes were really slow, and in 2013, prisoners got together again. More than 30,000 prisoners across the state refused food for more than a month.
Wow.
And again, this brought national and international attention. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture was paying attention to what was going on in California, and people were really very critical of these kinds of conditions. The United Nations says more than 15 days in a place like Pelican Bay constitutes torture. So that, you know, raised all kinds of questions about what people were doing here. They started to look into the cases and found out that there were these guys who were there just because of their tattoos and what they were reading. And it ultimately led to drastic reforms.
Well, and you mentioned near the end of the book, one judge is reviewing a case and he's looking. The tattoos have been on this prisoner for decades by now. And the judge wants to know, well, you still have them on. And so the question is obvious, like, so how is a prisoner supposed to take off his tattoos to show there is no affiliation anymore? I mean, there are too many catch-22s to handle.
Absolutely. You know, I tell the story in the book.
And he
of
was
a,
deprived. Of, I mean, he was.
Of a prisoner who was sent to prison with a life without parole sentence as a juvenile, which now many courts are reconsidering. The
yes.
Supreme Court has said that in many cases that's unconstitutional to send someone who was under 18 at the time of their crime to prison for life without the possibility of parole. It turns out there's dozens of these guys who ended up in isolation. Part, you imagine you go to prison when you're 17 or 18, you're incredibly scared. A lot of guys do try to affiliate with gangs. They end up with these tattoos. They're trying to sort of make sure that they're safe when they're young and scared. In at least one case I witnessed, the judge asked the question of the prisoner of, well, couldn't you have these tattoos removed to prove that you were no longer part of the game? But from isolation, it's sort of hard to imagine how you would do that. There are certainly tattoo removal programs, but not very robust in prison and certainly not in isolation.
You didn't editorialize in your book, but that judge was doing a little mind game number with, you know, it seemed like he was pretty set in his ruling, but he's telling somebody in solitary confinement, the judge is going to sleep on his decision. Mm. So it's like, it's gratuitous. Mm. I mean,
these are incredibly politically complex decisions. And the judge in that case ultimately did say that this prisoner should have a chance at parole. So he reduced the sentence from life without parole. And given new laws in California, juveniles have a chance at parole much sooner. So they have to go before the parole board. So this prisoner hopefully will go before the parole board within the next few years, at least to have a chance to have his release considered. So in the end, the judge made an incredibly progressive decision, I think, in one of the first cases to evaluate this. But, you know, judges are elected in California, and there's a really tough question of the optics of someone who's supposed to be the worst of the worst and how much investigation it takes to understand whether that's true or not and how little evidence we often have to even make that assessment.
Well, and in the back of my mind, I'm processing that other political problem, that fiscal issue is households that are having a difficult time, a regular civilian household with making ends meet and trying to cover education costs, and they're looking at the expense of any kind of rehabilitation in any of the penal institutions, and they're saying, well, would we support rehabilitation services when we as a household in civilian life can't make our own, can't keep the services up? So it's sort of like, it is a really complicated kind of political pitch for some sectors.
Yes, although I'll say one of the problems with isolation, and part of why I think there's been such successful reforms in the last few years, is that it costs about $90,000 per prisoner per year to keep someone in solitary confinement at Pelican Bay. We could send 4 or 5 students to the Cal State University system for that cost.
Right,
so it's not a cost saving.
Well,
also, turns out people are being released directly from long-term solitary confinement, and that has incredible costs for our community if they haven't received any kinds of resources while they're there. And I think people are beginning to understand the sheer expense of these policies.
And you do mention, we have many, many more questions. I'm going to save some of them for when we can maybe have, when Michael's recovered and have you back, and there's some very particular ones. But you mention in your book about how there is no safety, there's nothing to catch the prisoner who's gone directly from solitary to the free world, but that there is nothing, and they're going from utter deprivation to a bombardment of everything. It's remarkable. There's nothing at all for them.
In the States,
or maybe it shouldn't be remarkable. It should be expected.
In the states like California, Texas, New York, that are the biggest users of long-term solitary confinement, studies suggest that hundreds of prisoners a month come directly out of long-term isolation onto the streets because, again, it's the prison system determining whether they go into isolation or not. And so when their criminal sentence expires, they have to be released directly from isolation, and they're often released directly onto the streets. And people like Michael can tell you about what an incredibly intense experience it is to go from lights on 24 hours a day in a concrete box into the busyness of a major urban street.
Yeah, we're going to let all that sink in. Michael was at the Beyond the Bars forum at UCLA this weekend, and he's able to recover enough that he can fly himself to Columbia University. He'll be there March 5th for anybody who might be listening in the Eastern time zone there. So we'll keep that in mind. I guess the final question for us while we're together now is, what is your outlook on reform, given that we, right up until seconds before we went on air, there is some Twitter activity about legal immigrants are getting rounded up and they're also in being incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So we talked about privatization of how these solitary confinement structures were all built up, but we're hearing privatization dialed up mm-hmm. in the national leadership mm-hmm. in this country. Mm-hmm. So I guess in just a few, well, I'll give you less than two minutes. What is your outlook on reform at this point? That's such a big bite to chew off now.
I'll just say one thing I think is incredibly important about reform is oversight. And one of the lessons, most powerful lessons of the hunger strike to me, is that when people are paying attention and we understand the basic facts, 500 people, more than 10 years right. in long-term solitary confinement, change becomes completely feasible and imaginable, and it happens quickly. As of the last few months, none of those 500 guys are still in isolation at Pelican Bay. They've all been reintegrated into the general prison population in the state of California, with one or two upsetting incidents, but basically no drastic changes in the culture of the prison system, suggesting that, you know, they didn't all need to be there for that length of time. And that was a matter of shining a spotlight on these institutions. And so I would say we have to keep paying attention. And I think detention and immigration is really important to think about because it's a place where we often don't have the information we need and we're not paying enough attention. And one of the historical narratives of solitary confinement is that we pay attention, we get reform, we stop paying attention, and we go back to our old practices or some variation on them. And so,
very
you know, that
old practices.
Exactly. I mean, we've had solitary confinement since the 1800s, if not before. So it is, you know, these moments of reform can be so heartening, but part of the reform needs to be institutionalizing the kind of oversight that makes sure we continue to pay attention and we don't let this happen again in some new and more destructive way. You know, we invent something under a new name with a new technological look where it's harder to see the harm, but we're still depriving people of really basic human connection.
And you had an opportunity to talk to one of the so-called, the architects, Carl Larson, and he had no intention of this being such a protracted sentence. So it's things that discretion administratively on each of these penal institution sites that were solitary confinement. It was this administrative discretion was beyond what he'd envisioned when he was putting all this in motion. I'm going to post where people can get involved in your civilian capacities with Solitary Watch and their Lifelines to Solitary tab. Karamet, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. It's a remarkable read. I want everybody to read this. I know we all have a lot to do, but we have more to do because our radars haven't been turned up enough on this ailing public that needs our attention.
Thank you so much for shedding light on it.
Thank you. My guest was Karamet Ryder. She's UCI Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society, talking about her book, 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement, published by Yale University Press, available, as I always say, at your favorite independent book dealer. That was my wrap. Next week, returning to the show will be Irvine City Principal Planner Bill Jacob on our city's general plan update. And Danielle Piomelli is going to come back too and talk about the science of cannabis now that the recreational use of it is legal in California. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.